and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Trump's false claim, along with his tweet that the Democrats are protecting MS-13 thugs, that the Democrats are behind what he calls a horrible law separating children from their parents at the border, when it is his zero-tolerance policy that is doing it. Wendy Young, the executive director of KIND, Kids in Need of Defense, the leading organization for the protection of unaccompanied children who enter the U.S. immigration system alone, joins us to analyze what is going on following reports of 1,500 kids missing inside the Health and Human Services Department of Refugee Resettlement. We'll look into whether the thousands of kids separated from their parents inside the system are being properly tracked, let alone taken care of, and assess whether the so-called sponsors taking these kids out of federal custody are not human traffickers who are exploiting them for cheap or slave labor, as indicated by a case of 8 children forced to work on an egg farm. Then we'll go to the UK to speak with Nick Cheeseman, a professor of democracy at the University of Birmingham, who has researched elections in more than 8 countries around the world, including Ghana, Kenya, Malawi, and Nigeria. He is the co-author of a new book, How to Rig an Election, and we will discuss how more and more despots around the world choose to have elections that offer the pretense of democracy rather than to rule as dictators. With recent rigged elections in Russia, Turkey, and Venezuela, examples of this trend, we will examine what can be done to restore meaning into democratic processes and prevent autocrats from claiming victories in elections they have rigged for themselves. Then finally, we will look into the report just released by a group of independent researchers at Harvard who have found that 4,645 people died in Puerto Rico during Hurricane Maria and its aftermath, in stark contrast to the official total of 64. Luis Martinez Fernandez, a professor of history at the University of Central Florida, who lives and teaches in Orlando, Florida, which has one of the world's highest concentrations of Puerto Ricans, joins us to discuss the absurdity of the official death toll and how the neglect following the devastation by Maria continues. And joining us now is Wendy Young, the executive director of KIND, Kids in Need of Defense, the leading organization for the protection of unaccompanied children who enter the U.S. immigration system alone. Previously, she served as chief counsel on immigration policy in the Senate Judiciary Committee on Immigration, Border Security, and Refugees, and held immigration policy positions with the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, the Women's Refugee Commission, the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops, and the National Council of La Raza. Welcome to Background Briefing, Wendy Young.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Wendy. And I imagine you were particularly alarmed by reports that up to 1,500 children were missing within the U.S. government who had been separated from their parents at the border and ended up in the Health and Human Services Department of Refugee Resettlement. But it's not quite clear, is it, that they're missing so much as this has never been properly organized, this system. Am I correct? The New York Times did a piece in their print edition on Tuesday dealing with some of the rhetoric versus the reality.
Yeah, what's happening here really is that the new administration has implemented a formal policy of separating children from their parents when they arrive at the border. So the parent is going into the custody of the Department of Homeland Security. The child is going into the custody of the Department of Health and Human Services. Effectively, what this means is the parent and child are forcibly separated, held in two different facilities, and typically not allowed to communicate with each other. And we've seen cases where the parent is actually deported while the child is left behind in U.S. federal custody. This is a tragic, harsh development from our perspective, because effectively what this administration is doing is creating unaccompanied children. It's a self-created crisis on the part of the administration that's causing untold trauma to the parent, to the child, and also actually creating additional bureaucracy and problems in a backlog system, because by virtue of being separated, the child's immigration case is now considered separately from the parent. So it's creating an additional backlog in an already backlog system. There is no win-win in this new policy. It is a lose-lose policy because it's creating government inefficiencies, and it's traumatizing young children. We've worked with children as young as 11 months old who've been forcibly separated from their parents.
And this was brought about by Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who announced this new zero-tolerance policy earlier this month, and that included, of course, criminal penalties. And the idea, of course, was to deter Central American refugees and their families from crossing the border illegally. And Sessions said, if you don't want your child separated, then don't bring them across the border illegally. So what is the legal way to do it? I thought if you showed up at the border and sought political asylum, if you're fleeing from drug cartels, et cetera, which is what's plaguing Honduras and El Salvador in particular, that there was a legal process.
That's correct. If a person is fleeing violence and persecution in their home country, if they present themselves at the U.S. border and they request refugee protection or asylum, as it's known in the United States, that is both legal under international law as well as domestic U.S. law. These are people who are complying with our system. They're doing everything right. And instead of adjudicating their case, figuring out whether they do indeed need protection or can safely return home, this administration is choosing to punish them. That's also going to create some really difficult protection issues for the children in particular, because as we ramp up on these law enforcement approaches to some of the most vulnerable children in the world, we are actually making them more prey to traffickers and human smugglers who are going to take advantage of them, take advantage of their fear, charge them more money, and take them on a very difficult, abusive trip to the United States.
So where does Donald Trump get this idea that he keeps tweeting about and talking about, that blaming the Democrats for this horrible law, as he calls it, of separating immigrant children from their parents? And, of course, a lot of people were offended by Ivanka Trump's tweeting out a picture of herself with her young son while these reports are coming out about children being ripped from the arms of their parents at the border. So where's Trump getting these information, or is this just cynical?
This is unfortunately another case of alternative facts. This is a policy that's originated in his administration about a month ago. They have formalized this policy, and they're now actively implementing it. So this is not a Democrat-created problem. This is something that they've generated, and they've been very explicit that they're doing it to punish families who arrive at our border and to deter families that may be considering trying to seek protection at our border from coming. So, you know, this bottom line, what this represents is the United States backing away from decades of a very strong, proud tradition of welcoming refugees and providing them safe haven from the kind of extreme violence that we're seeing going on in Central America. We are literally, through these policies, and this is one of many that they've been incrementally implementing over the past several months, we are returning these people back to potentially death. And in our program, we work, again, with kids that are as young as babies who are fleeing very specific violence targeting them as children.
And again, I'm speaking with Wendy Young, who is the Executive Director of KIND, Kids in Need of Defense, the leading organization for the protection of unaccompanied children who enter the U.S. immigration system alone. Previously, she served as Chief Counsel on Immigration Policy in the Senate Judiciary Subcommittee on Immigration, Border Security, and Refugees, and held immigration policy positions with the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, the Women's Refugee Commission, the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops, and the National Council of La Raza. Well, I suppose, just touching on Trump and the cynical lies that he puts out, he also, in his tweet, blaming the Democrats for what he's doing, ripping the children from their parents at the border. He also went on to say, we must, in caps, continue building the wall, in caps. Democrats are protecting MS-13 thugs, all in caps. Now, he previously blamed Nancy Pelosi, saying she's protecting MS-13 thugs. That's really cynical, isn't it? I mean, there's no evidence. Who the hell would want to protect these kind of people? This is really a smear tactic, isn't it, to sort of demonize all the immigrants from Central and South America?
In fact, the reality is just the reverse. These are people who are fleeing countries who are that are plagued by gang violence. They're the victims of gang violence. They're trying to escape MS-13 and similar gangs to protect their lives and safety. So, yes, it is a completely cynical manipulation of the facts.
So going back to the Obama administration, apparently in 2016, the Senate Homeland Security Subcommittee, chaired by Senator Rob Portman, a Republican of Ohio, apparently they released a report finding that the department, being Homeland Security, had failed to establish procedures to protect unaccompanied minors from being turned over to smugglers or human traffickers. And they found that 8 children had been placed with human traffickers and were forced to work on an egg farm. So when they talk about these kids in the system, about 8,000 in total, 1,500 of whom have slipped through the cracks, how many of them are ending up slave labor or cheap labor? Do we know?
We don't know. You know, in terms of data, we don't know the exact numbers, but I can tell you this. This is exactly why we need to improve the system that's in place, not tear it down, which is what the current administration is doing, and make sure that these children, when they're released from custody, are provided the kind of services that keep them in the system so that they can pursue their claim to asylum, but also offer them protection from further abuses once here. The egg farm case is a tragic example of what can happen when we don't provide those kind of resources. And I can tell you from our own experience at KIND, children who are matched with counsel, and what we do largely is match them with counsel from private law firms and corporate legal departments, those children actually do stay in the system. Well over 95% appear for the proceedings. We know exactly where they are, and we win about 98% of our cases, moving the children into legal status, into protection, so that they can move on with their lives. So instead of creating these, you know, walls or whatever barrier you want to try and prevent these children who are fleeing extreme violence from coming, what we need to do is really lean in, provide them the services that ensure that they're safe and that we can determine whether they should remain here in the United States or be returned home.
But again, it appears that the Trump administration, in spite of what they say, trying to blame the Democrats, that they're the ones not only causing this humanitarian disaster, this appalling behavior, this cruelty being done in the name of American citizens. My understanding is that ICE is also now has a policy called Gotcha, where immigrants showing up for hearings before immigration courts are being deported. So it seems like, you know, they're talking about, you know, having procedures on the one hand, but abusing those procedures that exist, inadequate as they appear to be.
Yeah. The irony is, through policies like that, really what they're doing is going after the lowest hanging fruit. They're going after people who are complying with our laws and with our systems, who are appearing for their immigration court hearings. They're targeting them because they know where they are, and they're picking them up and deporting them. That is going to create a tremendous backlash where people are going to be incredibly fearful about going to their court hearing. That's exactly what we don't want people to do. We really want people in the process so we can figure out, again, whether they qualify for protection or can return home.
Right, but this appears to be planned. This is not happening by accident. I don't think Border Patrol and ICE does stuff on their own. They're not off the reservation, surely. It would seem to me that this attitude must be coming from the top, if not the orders coming from the top, either from the president or from his chief of staff, John Kelly, who was the former head of Homeland Security, and he has a well-documented hostility to immigrants. He, after all, said about, in response to questions about the kids missing, you know, what happens to these kids that are torn away from their families, and he said, well, they go into foster care or whatever, you know?
Yeah, this is truly coordinated out of the White House. These aren't, you know, federal agencies going rogue and developing and implementing policies on their own. They're being told what to do by the White House. And, you know, the comment that they go into foster care or whatever, I think at a minimum we need to acknowledge that these are young children, and like any child, regardless of what border they find themselves on the other side of, deserves and needs certain forms of protection, not a kind of laissez-faire whatever attitude. And, you know, I would just ask those in policy-making positions, how would you like your child to be treated if they found themselves in a foreign country alone?
So obviously, Wendy, the audience are upset when they hear this kind of information. And frankly, it's upsetting for me as well. So given the hostility of this government, given the cynicism, given how much they play to the kind of nativist sort of quasi-racist base that that Trump is obviously throwing a bone, trying to suggest that the Democrats are protecting MS-13 and they're responsible for anything that may look cruel and unusual that's happening on the border. And in general, playing to, I think, an anti-immigrant sentiment. After all, this is the president who began his entire campaign by demonizing Mexicans, saying that they were murderers and rapists. So if that's what's going on here, what's your sense of how to organize a pushback? I mean, I don't believe that the majority of Americans or anything like the majority of the Americans are cruel and racist and reflect the kind of casual racism that Roseanne Barr reflected in her tweets today, which managed to get ABC to cancel her popular show on ABC, Roseanne.
I agree. I mean, these policies really cross a line, and I think the vast majority of Americans don't want these things being done in the name of the American people. It kind of hits people at a gut level. And, you know, I think it's important for people to step up, speak out. I can tell you through our own work at KIND in the provision of legal services to these children that we've had an extraordinary response, not just from lawyers, but from just people who want to step forward and do something for these kids. That's the American tradition. And I think that, you know, we're happy to help people organize, and I would just ask people to say something, because otherwise it will be done in our name, and it's terribly damaging to our tradition and our reputation.
You mean say something to their representatives?
Yes, exactly.
So, but just in closing, though, immediately, what can be done to prevent these kids in the system from being exploited by these so-called sponsors who end up putting them into some sort of factory farm or some form of cheap or slave labor?
We've really been building very carefully over the past 15 years or so a system to ensure that kids are protected from that kind of violence. There have been, unfortunately, tragic examples where the system has failed. So we need to resource the system, and we need to learn from those horrible experiences to continue to build a system that's really child-oriented, that's child-protective, and take it out, if you will, of the debate around immigration that's raging in the country, and just remember these are kids. So let's do what's right for children. We know how to do this. We do it all the time. We can do it better for these kids. So we need to invest in the system.
But at the Washington level, as opposed to in terms of people writing into their congressmen, is there any bipartisan effort here to deal with this really shameful situation?
Well, there's definitely conversations going on in Congress in particular, and, you know, we need to encourage that. I think the solutions truly need to be found on a bipartisan basis. And if you look back over the decades, immigration policy really was built by reaching across the aisle and working together and finding those places where we compromise and finding those places where we can move forward together. And I think certainly children should be something that galvanizes people to work together.
Well, Wendy Young, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Wendy Young, who's Executive Director of KIND, Kids in Need of Defense, the leading organization for the protection of unaccompanied children who enter the United States immigration system alone. Previously, she served as Chief Counsel on Immigration Policy in the Senate Judiciary Subcommittee on Immigration, Border Security, and Refugees, and held immigration policy positions with the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, the Women's Refugee Commission, the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops, and the National Council of La Raza. We're going to take a brief station break and back and go to the UK to speak with the author of a new book just out, How to Rig an Election.
There's a place where I've been told every street is paved with gold, and it's just across the borderline.
this ain't exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't exactly there. From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now from the UK is Nick Cheeseman, a professor of democracy at the University of Birmingham. He's the author of Democracy in Africa, Successes, Failures, and the Struggle for Political Reform. He has researched elections in more than 8 countries around the world, including Ghana, Kenya, Malawi, and Nigeria. And his latest book, co-authored with Brian Klass, is How to Rig an Election. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nick Cheeseman.
It's great to be here.
Well, Nick, it seems like you and Brian Klass have sort of brought to the table something that is very depressing in terms of people who understand that there is a struggle between democracy and autocracy underway across the globe. The autocrats seem to be winning. Democracy seems to be very frail and vulnerable. But what is particularly depressing is the fact that you have brought to the table, which is that autocrats around the world actually prefer to use the trappings of democracy, which they manipulate in order to justify their rules. And they are actually more successful than outright autocrats who ban elections and rule as dictators.
Absolutely. I mean, we hope it's not a depressing book. It's written to try and save democracy and to give us some reasons for hope. Rather than to kind of put democracy in the coffin and put the final nails in. But the message of the book is a very serious one, which is that we've in a way kind of missed this trend. We've been a little bit complacent about the strength of democracy around the world. And actually, when we sort of sit up and really take note of what's going on, there's a really worrying trend, which is, as you say, that the number of elections that are being held every year is going up, but the quality of those elections in many cases is actually going down. And as you say, we see leaders who are not simply kind of, you know, stumbling along, just, you know, scraping by with an election victory here, an election victory there, but who are actually manipulating elections to strengthen their positions. So authoritarian leaders we thought were on their last legs, who actually managed to find a way through elections to reinvigorate their regimes. And I think the idea that, you know, kind of authoritarian leaders and fake Democrats could sort of rig elections was something that we all knew. But the idea that it could actually make them stronger is something that we didn't really expect to find when we started researching the book. And I think that's one of the things in the book that's really taken people by surprise.
And is Vladimir Putin, he certainly has perfected that system. Was he one of the people who discovered it in the sense that he has been referred to as a managed democracy? And the people like his Alexander Surkov, who have developed many of the propaganda and media techniques that Putin uses to rule, he's called a political technologist. So am I right in suggesting that maybe Russia under Putin is at the leading edge of this new art of election manipulation?
Absolutely. I mean, I quite like the term managed democracy, but what I don't like about it is it kind of implies that there's more democracy than is probably really there. And I think, you know, that's why we kind of try and stick to terms which imply that these regimes at their very core authoritarian. But I completely agree with you. Putin is a great example of this. I mean, if you were to go sort of 20, 30 years ago and you were to look at the average authoritarian system, it would have been a one-party state like the former Soviet Union. It would have been a military regime like so many in Latin America and Africa. And none of those systems would have held, you know, multi-party elections. Today, the average one-party state is very, the average authoritarian regime, sorry, is very different. It actually does hold elections, but it rigs them. And Putin is a classic example of this. I mean, he uses elections to make it look like he's a democratically elected leader, to make it look like he has that mass popular support. But of course, the political system is so tightly controlled that he guarantees that he wins the elections. And we actually don't really know how popular he is. Now, one thing that's really important to say is that we don't say in the book that any of the people who are rigging elections are necessarily deeply unpopular with all parts of their population. Most of these guys know, and in most cases it is guys, you know, this is a male-dominated world, that most of them know that it's much easier to manipulate in Reagan election if you've actually got a significant base of support to start with. If you can get 30-40% of the vote legitimately, you only need to rig 10-15% of the vote, which is much, much easier. So it's not the case that they don't have support, but what they're doing often is they're managing the process at the margins, taking 10-15% off the opposition, giving themselves an extra 10-15%, and that's what makes all the difference in terms of giving them a comfortable victory time after time.
And, of course, in the last election, Putin actually, the opposition, Navalny, the opposition leader, was banned from running. He tried to encourage people not to vote, to delegitimize the idea that this was an election in any meaningful sense that we would understand it. And, of course, the real opposition figures, Boris Nemtsov, was murdered just outside the Kremlin. So already you have an atmosphere that it's pretty scary to be an opposition politician in Russia to begin with. And if you're brave like Navalny, they'll marginalize you and throw green paint in your face and all this kind of stuff. And by the way, they're holding his brother, who he's very close to, in solitary confinement forever just to put the squeeze on Navalny. But meanwhile, Putin allows, you know, the equivalent of Kim Kardashian to run in opposition to him, knowing that the people out in the country, the narod, are not going to vote for some little Moscow socialite. So he's got it pretty well planned, has he not?
Well, the best strategy if you're a leader is to pick your opponents, right? Pick the people you think you can beat and exclude the others. And there are some fantastic examples in the book of how, you know, leaders have actually managed to effectively choose the people they run against. So we've got a great example from Madagascar where the president stops his main rival from competing against him by basically closing down the airports whenever the plane carrying the opposition leader is trying to land in the country. And because the opposition leader needs to hand in his papers personally to be able to actually make it onto the ballot in the presidential election, he gets disqualified on a legal technicality. So you've got all these different ways that leaders kind of use the premise of the law. You're often invoking the law, something about the law, to do it, but use it to kick out the main rivals who would actually defeat them. And of course, what that then allows them to do is to hold reasonably good quality elections on the day. Because you can have a reasonably good quality election on the day if all the people who might beat you are not able to stand. And that then raises a really good question, which goes back to what you were initially saying at the very beginning of that statement about Russia and the opposition, which is, how do you fight back against that? And maybe the best way in some cases to fight back against that is not to compete in the election, because then you legitimate the election, but to boycott it, to try and deny the authoritarian leader the legitimacy that he's trying to get out of that process. And I think that's where we have to start thinking about, you know, as opposition parties, as civil society organizations, and as international election observers, do we turn up at these contests knowing that if we do, we may have to kind of go through a process of rigmarole, at the end of which we kind of rubber stamp the process. Maybe we say it's a C-minus election or a D-minus election, but we very rarely actually say the election is not good enough and actually isn't free and fair and should be run again. Or do we actually say, you know what, we can see what's being done here. We can see how the system is being manipulated. We can see that this is not a democracy, and we actually refuse to go in the first place, undermining the leader's legitimacy by saying this is not a legitimate process and preventing him from getting the kind of reflection of democracy that happens if everybody turns up and takes part.
So since you spent quite a lot of time in Africa, Nick Cheeseman, observing elections there in Ghana, Kenya, Malawi and Nigeria, Kenya, of course, became a sort of testing ground, as far as I know, for Cambridge Analytica. Cambridge Analytica played an important role in Brexit and in also perhaps even a key role in the Trump campaign. Recently, a whistleblower from Cambridge Analytica has testified before the British Parliament, Christopher Wiley. He also testified here in the United States as well before the Senate. And much of what he said is pretty alarming. What did the former head who stepped down of Cambridge Analytica actually do in Kenya? There was also, I mean, indication from Christopher Wiley that he thought perhaps the original head of Cambridge Analytica might have been murdered in Kenya.
I think, I mean, basically, we don't have a full picture because no one on the government side has confirmed this and no one on the Cambridge side has confirmed this to actually give us the full details. My sense is that in the Kenyan case, actually, Cambridge did fairly kind of old-fashioned stuff. They help to, you know, design campaigns. They help to put together slogans. They help to push adverts out and manage the campaign in a fairly old school way. The kind of stuff that Cambridge Analytica often talks about, the kind of strategies and tactics they talk about when it comes to big data, manipulating, for example, information that they could get off Facebook or Twitter, profiling voters, that kind of thing. It's plausible to me that they were doing that in the Brexit election. It's plausible they did that in the last US election. It's less plausible somewhere like Kenya, simply because far fewer people are online, far fewer people are on Facebook. So some of that may have happened, but the impact of that on the election would have been lower in the Kenyan context, simply because there were less people online to see those messages and less big data available for Cambridge Analytica to manipulate. So my sense is that in the Kenyan case, they are maybe sort of pushing a fairly divisive message, encouraging the ruling party to use divisive strategies, helping them to put those together. And that was kind of their impact. And one of the reasons why that was very controversial in Kenya is, of course, Kenya experienced a lot of electoral violence after 2007, and people felt that this election could be very tense and potentially could lead to political violence. And therefore, the idea of a foreign company that was pushing divisive messages was highly controversial because people feared that it could lead to violence. I do think it's probably worth saying, though, that, you know, Kenyan leaders themselves are quite good at designing their own divisive messages. And I'm not entirely sure that in the Kenyan case, a similar kind of strategy wouldn't evolve in the absence of Cambridge Analytica.
Well, but the issue involved in what happened to the American elections in 2016 are all about whether or not Russia used these techniques and manipulated the electorate in the United States for that very purpose of exploiting divisions that already exist and exacerbating them. For example, the data dump from the DNC revealing what Hillary Clinton and her people had done to try and screw with Bernie Sanders' chances, that was released by Julian Assange of WikiLeaks on the very eve of the Democratic Convention. And of course, the whole point of the Democratic Convention was to try and get the Bernie people and the Hillary people into a kind of kumbaya moment and to bury the hatchet. And of course, it was so obvious that the Russians using Assange had the opposite idea.
Absolutely, I agree. But I think one thing that's really important to note here is that Cambridge Analytica in many ways is the tip of the iceberg. You know, we often focus on Cambridge Analytica because it's one of the most high-profile companies, because it did the work for the Trump campaign, because we know it was involved in the Brexit campaign and in Kenya and so on. And Cambridge Analytica has an awful lot to answer for. If you look at some of the things that they claim that they can do in the undercover exposés that have been done, it's really terrible. And you know, I think many people were rightly pleased when they went out of business because they thought that was appropriate given the kind of strategies the company had said it was using. But I think what we need to keep sight of here is that Cambridge Analytica is one of thousands and thousands of companies who are trying to do similar things, who are selling their strategies and their capabilities to the highest bidder. And it's also important to keep in mind that while we have that kind of formal set of companies trying to sell these strategies to political leaders, we also see an organic process happening. I mean, some of the fake news stories in the last election were not commandeered by a company like Cambridge Analytica. They were coming more organically from troll farms and factories in different parts of the world, some of which influenced by Russia, some of which not. And I think one of the broader concerns that I would have moving forward is that anybody now who has access to the internet can put fake news stories online, link them to adverts, make revenue from it. And people who are better at this are going to make more money. So we're going to get more and more people doing this as a source of income. And that process can be completely organic. It doesn't have to be organized. It doesn't have to be led by foreign powers. It could just be someone wanting to make some money to take their girlfriend on holiday. And the fact that that has become so easy and that those stories have become so popular is a really worrying thing, because it means that even if we were to get the foreign governments out of these elections, even if we were to get those companies out of these elections, we still have to deal with the fact that there's a mass of people out there who are doing this on their own as well.
Well, but in the case of Russia, it seems to be state policy and what some people are referring to as fourth generation warfare, where obviously Putin wants to hit back at the West, and particularly the US, for the sanctions which are hurting him as a result of annexing Crimea and invading Ukraine. He doesn't have a lot of options, certainly doesn't have particularly good military options. So he's discovered the real Achilles heel. And much of what we're talking about seems to be so much more effective if the operation is being run by a foreign intelligence service, because throughout the Cold War, both the U.S. and the USSR had, in terms of the CIA, they have the white side of the house, which is analysis, the black side of the house, which is operations, and the gray side, which is propaganda. And so both sides throughout the Cold War perfected a lot of these techniques. They are the best equipped, are they not, intelligence services?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, they've got a number of advantages. Of course, they're particularly well-placed when it comes to doing things like hacking into email accounts. And, of course, many of the most effective stories in this bracket are ones that were gained as a result of hacking into email accounts and then being able to release those emails in different ways. So security forces have a number of advantages, and this is one reason why, you know, I think when we move to kind of authoritarian states in other parts of the world, again, we have a major reason to be concerned, because, of course, it's the governments in these countries that are mostly going to be able to take the best advantage of this. On the one hand, they're the ones that are going to have the money to be able to employ companies like Cambridge Analytica, which are very expensive to run. And at the same time, they're going to be the ones with the expertise and the technical expertise to manipulate propaganda, hack into email accounts, and make best use of that information. So while we often think about the internet as a kind of neutral force that can be used by both sides, in reality, as you say, the ruling party and security forces and spy networks that have been established for many years are the ones who are best placed to really take advantage of that. And that reinforces all of the advantages that ruling parties tend to have in elections anyway.
So some of the, just in closing, some of the countries, though, that have done election rigging, I think, have gone somewhat under the radar that you're investigating in your new book, Nick Cheeseman, How to Rig an Election. Argentina, well, Zimbabwe, that's no surprise. Brazil, India, Nigeria, Russia, and, of course, the U.S. So just in closing, give us some examples of countries that you would not normally think were involved in this kind of election rigging, particularly those that, you know, have a recent democratic tradition, like, for example, Argentina and Brazil.
Well, I mean, one of the things we see in Brazil is that, less so at the presidential level, but when you move to the local level, for example, a phenomenal amount of violence around elections at the local level in Brazil, with many, many people dying often in local elections, and the use of widespread intimidation, partly because of the connection between political networks and, in some cases, criminal networks. So in each of these cases, we're talking about different strategies of rigging that kind of warp the electoral framework in different ways. In some cases, it's widespread violence that is far greater than people would perhaps imagine looking from the outside. In other cases, it's widespread vote buying in elections that has become so rampant that we just ignore it. And even in the democracies of Africa, for example, countries that we talk about as becoming, you know, much more stable and consolidated, we see rampant vote buying around elections. It's become so commonplace that it's kind of almost discounted now. But the other thing we point out in the book is that, you know, on a much less significant scale and a less problematic scale, but nonetheless important, we see significant democratic problems in the United States and the United Kingdom as well. And one of the arguments of the book is that although, you know, we highlight for most of the book these examples from other countries in which, you know, we see some amazing stories of election rigging, there are big problems when it comes to the U.S. in terms of gerrymandering and districts in which essentially, you know, leaders are selecting their own voters rather than the other way around. We see problems in terms of voter suppression and the use of restrictive voter ID regulations as a way of disempowering certain parts of the population from voting. And in the United Kingdom, we see routine problems of almost all of the parties breaking campaign finance laws. So one of the problems that we talk about in the book is that if we, meaning the international community or the West, or the countries that have historically played a big role trying to promote democracy, if we want to speak with any kind of authority on these issues, we also need to get our own house in order and reflect on the democratic the democratic gaps in our own political systems. And so one of the things that people often, I think, find most interesting about the book is actually the way it reflects from these broader experiences back to the, what's going on today in established democracies, pointing out that actually we don't have perfect systems either. And that's perhaps the best example of countries that we often assume have achieved democratic status that actually have significant problems in their elections.
Well, Nick Cheeseman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with Nick Cheeseman, who's a professor of democracy at the University of Birmingham. He's the author of Democracy in Africa, Successes, Failures, and the Struggle for Political Reform. He has researched elections in more than 8 countries around the world, including Ghana, Kenya, Malawi, and Nigeria. And his latest book, co-authored with Brian Klass, is How to Rig an Election. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the report just released by a group of independent researchers at Harvard, which found that 4,645 people died in Puerto Rico during Hurricane Maria and its aftermath, in stark contrast to the official total of 64.
And to the man who would be king, I would say only one thing. And to the man who would be king, I would say only one thing. La 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 la.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Luis Martinez Fernandez, a professor of history at the University of Central Florida. He is an historian of Latin America and the Caribbean who focuses on the histories of Cuba, Puerto Rico, and the Dominican Republic. He was born in Cuba, graduated from a Puerto Rican university, and currently lives and teaches in Orlando, Florida, which is one of the world's highest concentrations of Puerto Ricans. Welcome to Background Briefing, Luis Martinez Fernandez.
Thank you, Ian. It's a pleasure to be with you again.
Well, thank you, Luis. And of course, since we last spoke, there's even more concentration of Puerto Ricans in Central Florida as a result of those who fled the island in the aftermath of Hurricane Maria.
That's very true. The number of people leaving the island in the last 2 years before the hurricane was about 80,000. And since the hurricane, that number has gone up.
And what do you have a current figure on? Because I'm hearing that it's going to perhaps affect the upcoming November elections in this important swing state of Florida.
That is very true. That may very well be the case. As you know, Puerto Ricans are U.S. citizens. So the only thing they need to do is to establish residency in Florida, and that allows them to vote like anybody else.
Which they can't do on the island itself of Puerto Rico, right?
That's correct. On the island, they can vote in local elections, but they cannot vote for the president. Once they move to the United States, that changes, of course.
So what do you make of this new report from a group of independent researchers at Harvard University who have found that they have a specific figure here, that 4,645 people died as a result of Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico, in spite of the fact that the official count is only 64?
Well, the Harvard numbers make far more sense than the extreme underestimate produced by the island. I was looking at some figures earlier today, and normally 80 people die each day in Puerto Rico. So how can you have 64 when we're talking about, I think the estimates are based on about 42 days beginning with the hurricane. So the Puerto Rico numbers are, I don't know what they are, but they're very, very low, and they're certainly not accurate.
Well, I recall at the time when President Trump went down to Puerto Rico in the aftermath of the hurricane, when the mayor of San Juan was telling us that people are in desperate and dire shape. He was tossing a bunch of paper towels at a group of people and saying that how great the rescue effort was and the recovery was great and ongoing. And he was proud of how few people had died. So we've heard anything but contradictory news since then of how difficult it has been to get electricity back and build up, rebuild infrastructure, and electricity and blackouts have happened on a repeated basis. So who's making up this absurd number of 64?
Those are the official numbers of the government, and they're based, from what I believe, on numbers and reported by funeral homes. And certainly Trump should not take any credit for a low number of deaths. If anything, the slow response most likely added to the death toll. So he's not a demographer. He's other things, but not a demographer.
Well, is that to say then that the people on the island aren't buying this, and the refugees from Puerto Rico who are now living where you are in Orlando, Florida, I take it they're not buying the official version?
No, virtually nobody's buying it, either on the island or among Puerto Ricans in the United States. I think this is part of the breakdown of the local government, which we have seen over the past few years, how basic services are not being delivered, or when delivered, low quality. So statistics is one of those areas where the government has also suffered.
Well, you know, this report from a group of independent researchers at Harvard University is in the New England Journal of Medicine, which is famous for being pretty rigorous about what appears in its pages. So I don't think there's any doubt about it. It's accuracy. But the divergence between 4,645 and 64 is in the realm of absurdity, is it not?
Yeah. It would be funny if it wasn't that sad. And again, the Harvard study is based on extensive research by top scholars, demographers, and others. And the Puerto Rican government numbers are just off, completely off. As I said earlier, 80 people die each day on the island. How can they have 64 for that entire period? The numbers just don't make sense.
So let's look into what possibly may be behind the real number. If you're still having blackouts on the island, I believe there was a couple of accidents where a bulldozer cut an important power line, and I think another accident happened with the main grid. And of course, there have been endless reports about how difficult it has been to get electricity back, and the original contract that somehow was connected to the Secretary of Interior, Ryan Zinke, some crony of his from Montana, who had a company that only had two employees, originally got the contract to rebuild the entire grid in Puerto Rico that was absolutely flattened. So there's been nothing but scandals about the grid. But I bring the grid up, Luis, because quite simply, if you don't have electricity and you have perishable food, but more importantly, perishable medicine, and you're on, rely on this medicine to stay alive, would that be a factor, along with not having air conditioning and other, and being able to have, refrigerated food, etc.? So how much? So that's a big factor, right? What's been going on?
It is. When you look at a large population of 3.5 million people on the island, there are thousands of people who on a daily basis receive treatment for numerous diseases. This could be dialysis. This could be chemotherapy. This could be a whole range of services that were disrupted. And that led to death. There's no question about that, that led to death. People who were not able to get medicine. I should also add another factor, which may not have happened at the time, but I'm hearing reports of a large number of suicides in Puerto Rico, particularly among the elderly who have become depressed in the aftermath of this hurricane.
So depressed because, I mean, first of all, hasn't there been enormous exodus of people? And then you've still got the wreckage around. It doesn't look like things have changed that much since the initial weeks after the hurricane passed.
Well, there has been a return to, I hesitate to use the word normality, because it's not quite where it was before the hurricane. But, you know, businesses are opening, universities and schools are in session. So there has been quite a bit of recovery.
But clearly, if there is this denial on the part of the officials about something as basic as how many people died as a result of Hurricane Maria, how can you trust the authorities? Obviously, you had during the aftermath, when there were questions about the recovery, you had, as I mentioned earlier, the mayor of San Juan saying one thing and the governor saying another. Do you still have that problem there, that you don't have anybody speaking with a kind of united voice about what's really going on there? I mean, frankly, I'd be more inclined to listen to the mayor of San Juan than the governor, but that's just my bias.
Yeah, there's obviously manipulation of statistics. That, of course, the fewer the number of deaths, the better the government of Puerto Rico looks in terms of having taken care of the population. Various countries report on that. For example, in Cuba, Cubans take pride out of the fact that they have been hit by enormous destructive hurricanes and very few people have died. So that is, I believe, in the best interest of the central government. Now, as to the mayor of San Juan, who is from another political party, you will never find these two parties and the leaders of these two parties agreeing on anything. This is just one more example of two sets of leaders who are at each other's throats and distrust one another.
So that's the same polarization we have here on the mainland, right?
Yes, that's very true.
So what do you think is the likely political future here? We mentioned earlier that the exodus of Puerto Ricans to Central Florida is probably going to make a difference in the November elections in the key swing state of Florida and favor the Democrats. Because I think it's pretty safe to say, isn't it, that Puerto Ricans were pretty disgusted with the Republicans and Donald Trump. And I believe it's the Republicans in the House that are screwing them to the wall in terms of the governance structure that exists, which gives Puerto Rico absolutely no flexibility in dealing with its own debt.
Yes. Well, earlier you mentioned President Trump tossing a paper towel at a crowd. That was such a disgraceful moment, and that's an image that remains in people's minds, certainly in mine. I don't know how he dared do that. So there's animosity towards Republicans, which is greater than usual. The other side of the equation is that Puerto Rican and Hispanic organizations and the Democratic Party in this part of the country, Central Florida, are making an incredible, extraordinary effort to get people to register to vote. And the reports I get is that that has been very successful and that those who have come are very energized to vote in November.
So would that mean, though, if the Democrats were able to pick up the House, it's a little less likely the Senate, but I interviewed an author recently who felt that the Democrats, if they ever get back in power, should use this power in the kind of ruthless way the Republicans have used power, for example, denying Obama's choice to sit on the Supreme Court, Merrick Garland, and in fact holding out so they could get put their guy on Gorsuch, which was a pretty raw example of just bare-knuckled power on the part of the Republicans. And the argument was that the Democrats should move to create statehood for both Washington, D.C. and for Puerto Rico, and that way they'd pick up four new senators, because the way the Senate is structured now, it's pretty much paralyzed ad infinitum.
Well, that's a good and interesting question. In terms of whether the Democrats should respond in kind, that's up to them. Politics are so dirty as we speak that who knows what's going to happen in November. Now, in terms of statehood for the island, I hope that everybody understands that that's not happening anytime soon and may not happen ever. There's a political party which is in power that promotes statehood, and that party keeps on selling this idea of statehood, and everything else is politicized around the issue of statehood. Let me tell you why that will not happen. For one thing, the United States is not ready to accept Puerto Rico as another state. That would be initiated by Congress, and the numbers are not there, and it's not going to happen. I believe that although Republicans would almost unanimously be against statehood, in Congress, some Democrats are not supportive of that either, especially with the intense racial animosities that are tearing this country apart. The other reason is that in order for Puerto Rico to become a state, they need to make the first effort to demonstrate that a large majority, and we're really talking up in the 80% or higher, that a large majority are in favor of statehood. And that's certainly not the case. What we have seen in the past is that statehood hovers around 45% when people vote in various plebiscites. So to get to 80 is not going to happen anytime soon. But there's a possibility that if Puerto Ricans are forced to decide between statehood or independence, then the statehood vote would be high. But still, it would be very problematic to have a new state in which a large percentage of the population would repudiate such status change.
Well, Luis Martinez Fernandez, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with Luis Martinez Fernandez, who's a professor of history at the University of Central Florida. He's a historian of Latin America and the Caribbean who focuses on the histories of Cuba, Puerto Rico, and the Dominican Republic. And he was born in Cuba, graduated from a Puerto Rican university, and currently lives and teaches in Orlando, Florida, which has one of the world's highest concentrations of Puerto Ricans. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Alejandra Lariva-Lutt. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.